Lecture 24, From Existentialism to Postmodernism.
Quite a few years ago, I was discussing an article that I had written with an editor, a friend, at Vogue magazine. She read it through and said to me, "But isn't this existentialism?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "I thought that was passé." Coming from an editor at Vogue, I suppose this judgment made sense. After all, if things don't go in and out of fashion, Vogue magazine doesn't have much to live for. But it took me back, and I realized, and as I say, this was a couple of decades ago, and I had to ask myself the question whether existentialism was itself a fashion, whether it was something that had sort of passed from France to America at a critical time in history, just after the Second World War. A couple of striking authors, mainly Camus and Sartre, had struck the American fancy, had inspired a generation of American authors who, at least for a short time, called themselves existentialists. Norman Mailer was an example. But then it passed on. And so existentialism belongs to the 40s and 50s. And after that, I have to see myself as something of a throwback. Well, I don't accept that. And I don't accept it just because I make a good part of my living talking and writing about existentialism, because it's to me something much more than a historical phase, something much more than just a period in recent philosophy, or something much more than simply a movement of the sort that one can label, stamp, can, and put on the shelf. It was Sartre himself who said, when he was asked about what is existentialism, he said that to try and define it is to freeze it. It's to treat it as no longer a living movement, but as something dead, something that can be simply classified. I think that's quite accurate. And in fact, Sartre himself was very concerned with the idea that existentialism as a movement didn't have any definitive core, even though he himself did more than anyone to try and stamp it with his own ideas. The truth is that existentialism is still a vibrant movement. And for that reason, I haven't spent really any time at all in the past 23 lectures trying to define what it is. I've noted with some frequency some terms that keep emerging as absolutely central. Looking at Sartre, the notions of freedom and responsibility. And looking back to Kierkegaard, the notion of freedom and choice again. Looking back to Nietzsche, there is a sense shared with Kierkegaard of enormous personal passion. And throughout all the figures we've talked about, there is a kind of strong individualistic streak, sometimes almost an individualist mania. And I'm thinking, for example, of certain aspects of Nietzsche and Kierkegaard in particular. But I wouldn't go so far as to define existentialism in any of these terms, although existentialism as a movement certainly vibrates around them. Because I think existentialism is still something very much alive. And although it started as a very European movement, and the figures we've talked about have all been Europeans, nevertheless, I think its real home is in America. And I think in the United States, what existentialism amounts to is more clearly instantiated than any place else in the world. What is that existentialism? Well, I don't want to repeat just the same terms again. So let me say something much more general and something in a way more provincial. Americans are very staunch individualists. At the same time, they're rather keenly aware, although sometimes philosophically uncomfortable with the idea, that there's a very strong sense of community that lies at the basis of American society. Americans are very concerned, as self-help books make amply clear, with the idea of self-realization and self-improvement, the very idea of picking oneself up by one's bootstraps and making something new out of oneself. To use the kind of term that Nietzsche deplored, the idea of self-improvement really defines a good deal of American society. The whole idea of social mobility, the whole idea of mobility in general, is something that is distinctively American, but I also think something distinctively existentialist. Even in Nietzsche, and to a lesser extent in Heidegger, where the idea of improving oneself, where the idea of creating oneself is really at a minimum. Nevertheless, this idea of self-assertiveness, of some sense of authenticity, some sense of self-realization, comes through as a dominant philosophy. And that's what I think existentialism is about. Nevertheless, my Vogue editor and friend clearly was onto something when she noted that existentialism was passé. Certainly, if we look at the climate in Europe, it is. And if we look at American universities, which often, in a kind of pandering way, follow the latest fashions in Europe, one doesn't hear too much about existentialism anymore. It's eclipsed by two generations of philosophers since Sartre, although Sartre lived long enough to see, in fact, both of them. The first generation is dominated by a single figure in Paris, someone with whom Sartre's relationships, personal relationships, were quite strained. But as you may have gathered from other things I've said, Sartre's personal relationships were quite strained with almost everyone. The character I'm thinking about is the anthropologist philosopher Claude Lévi-Strauss, who made quite a reputation for himself with a philosophy which is called structuralism. The details of what counts as structuralism is something I think is way beyond the scope of this lecture. But to begin with, it was, in fact, an anthropological insight. And what Lévi-Strauss was concerned with was the structural similarities which all societies shared in common. And what he tried to do in his various studies of myth, ritual, and social custom was to find a system, a set of structures which were common to every society. And the idea was that the particulars of the different societies could be understood within that structure. But despite his search for universals, Lévi-Strauss clearly had an anthropologist's view of the world. And what he attacks in Sartre, I think, is very well taken, namely, the idea that Sartre really is, despite all pretenses to the contrary, not the universal picture of humanity so much as an hyper-intellectual Parisian who is taking his phenomenology as an unwarranted generalization about what human consciousness and human life is like. What Lévi-Strauss emphasizes, in particular in his studies of what he called the savage mind, the primitive mind, is the differences between different people, and in particular, the differences in the notion of consciousness, which could be accurately applied to different cultures. Merleau-Ponty, Sartre's friend, makes a similar criticism when he asks Sartre whether a peasant in Latin America who has never been educated, who has never heard a radio, who has no idea how people in other countries live, can be expected to have the kinds of choices and consequently the kinds of responsibility that Sartre is talking about. I think Lévi-Strauss hits an important point, but that's only the first generation in which Sartre is attacked. The second generation, in some ways, is more insidious with regard to Sartre. The second generation, I would consider those philosophers who make up what is currently called postmodernism. And I would name, in particular, the philosophers of Michel Foucault, Jacques Derrida, Gilles Deleuze, and Roland Barthes. They have a number of theses in common, although here again, what we find is a group more of individuals than of collectivities. But two theses, I think, come to the fore, which are in striking contrast with Sartre's philosophy. The first is characterized in the rather stunning phrase, which is used by both Barthes and Foucault, the death of the author. And it refers to something which has often been commented upon, often ridiculed. And it's the idea that when we read books, the idea that books are written by an author is an absolute way of misunderstanding what they are about. Of course, there is a sense in which people write books, but to confuse the writer of books with the author is exactly the kind of fallacy that Barthes and Foucault are concerned about. To talk about the death of the author is a particularly dramatic way of bringing to life a thesis that had been flying around in literary criticism circles for quite some time. It has to do with the way to read and understand books, which is not our primary concern here. But it also has to do with the idea that the subject and subjectivity, the two key concepts in not only Sartre but in the whole Cartesian tradition, have in some way been displaced and misunderstood. And that to read a book in terms of the intentions of an author is precisely to misunderstand it. The second notion has to do with an impersonal play of forces, which in people like Foucault and Deleuze replaces an emphasis on agency and particularly responsibility in Sartre. In writing about Nietzsche, for example, Gilles Deleuze, in a very well-known book in France, argues in place of Nietzsche's talk about the dynamics of action, he talks instead about the impersonality of the forces, in particular the sorts of forces that Nietzsche points to in his mythology, the Apollonian versus the Dionysian and so on, the reactive forces of the slave versus the more aggressive forces of the master. But the idea is that we get rid of any semblance of human responsibility and decision-making. And we get rid of that image that I presented in my exposition of Nietzsche's genealogy, in which the slave or slaves make a kind of brilliant decision to undermine the masters. All such talk disappears, and instead what we're left with is a picture that looks very much, in a superficial reading, like a physical treatise. And that, of course, is just the idea. Because what these two notions together, the death of the author, and this notion of the impersonal play of forces intend to do is really kill subjectivity, and in particular, the notion of subjectivity as Sartre understood it. Now, I would argue that on the one hand, something very important is going on here. But on the other hand, I would suggest that there's a kind of conspiracy of silence regarding Sartre's own significance for both of these movements, structuralism and postmodernism, or what is sometimes in the United States called poststructuralism. The conspiracy of silence has to do with just how much Sartre's own notion of consciousness and subjectivity informs and, in a way, forms the basis of the kind of philosophy that Foucault and Derrida and Deleuze and Barthes want to argue. His name is virtually never mentioned in their texts, but reading, for example, the biography of Foucault by James Miller, one finds Foucault sitting in a lecture with Deleuze and saying to each other how this is really the main target against which all of their philosophy is to be directed. Whether Sartre is, in a way, the model, or whether he is simply the target, nevertheless, his importance in French philosophy since his death is, I think, something which has been a very well-kept secret. But I think it's not just a question of his being a target, something I'll talk about shortly. But I think also, if you seriously consider Sartre's view of consciousness and take very seriously the sorts of things he says about nothingness and so on, he comes up with a picture which can be very easily accommodated to the postmodernist picture. What the postmodernists want to do when they reject subjectivity and with it reject phenomenology is to say that there's only really a third-person way of looking at ourselves, that the first-person way, in a way, is corrupt or self-deceptive, that when they describe the impersonal play of forces, and when they describe a book without an author, what they're rejecting in many ways is precisely that notion of consciousness which Sartre anticipated, and the idea that consciousness is not something which can be readily individuated, something readily identified. And in many ways, one might say what they're confusing in Sartre is the distinction which he makes very early between consciousness and subjectivity on the one hand and the self on the other. But the postmodernists reject both self and consciousness together. And with the third-person vocabulary, it's very often very difficult to know what, if anything, is supposed to replace them. Certainly there is an inimitable place for the first-person perspective, namely my view of myself and the world from my position. But it's not clear in a good amount of the postmodernist writing exactly how one can account for the fact that there is such a first-person position. It's also true that the postmodernists rather famously reject rationality, objectivity, truth and knowledge, although all these claims would have to be very carefully stated in a longer exposition of their views. But of course, the rejection of rationality is something that goes back throughout the history of existentialism, certainly in Kierkegaard, the idea that rationality is not adequate to answer the questions concerning the choices we have in life is something that pervades virtually all the authors we've talked about. And even Sartre, who I would say is the most rationalistic of the five authors we discussed in detail, it's pretty clear that when it comes to fundamental choices, there is no ultimate criterion, there is no ultimate standard, there is no rational guideline to deal with. In fact, Sartre tells a story which is very famous in one of his more popular essays about the young student who comes to him not quite sure what he's supposed to do. His brothers have been killed in the war, and at the same time, he is the only one left, and he's taking care of his mother. And so he has a very real question about whether his obligation is to avenge his brothers by going off and fighting, or whether he should stay with his mother, the obligation of a dutiful son. Sartre remarks, and I'm not sure what he would have said to the individual in question, actually, but Sartre remarks that there is nothing to tell him, that the truth is that what he's looking for is a criterion for the right thing to do, something objective, something rational. But the truth is that it's not as if one finds the principle and on the basis of it makes the decision. But just as we said with regard to many other aspects of human nature, it's rather the case that first one decides what to do, and then one gathers around the principles to justify it. So the young student has to decide whether avenging his brothers is what he will do, and consequently whether revenge or avenging is the principle that he is acting upon, or whether he will stay with his mother, and consequently whether filial piety is the principle on which he is acting. In short, what Sartre is doing is already agreeing with the postmodernists that rationality doesn't have the privileged place that it has had throughout the history of philosophy. And with it, although this is not a primary concern of either his or the postmodernists, notions of objectivity, truth, and knowledge have to be put on a back burner as well. Because whatever we mean by objectivity, whatever we mean by truth and knowledge, they can't be of the sort that philosophers before Sartre, notably philosophers in the Kantian tradition, tried to make it out to be. But I think all this is, in a way, superficial. Because Nietzsche said, when we read a philosophy, we have to always ask, what's the moral objective? What is this philosopher trying to express? And the idea is that it all is a kind of personal confession. But personal confessions can often be political confessions too. And I think one way of understanding the eclipse of Sartre and his rejection by the postmodernists is in terms which certainly Foucault and Deleuze have made quite explicit. And that is, what they reject is what they call his Enlightenment project. Now, this can be understood in a number of different ways. First of all, despite his queries about rationality and rational standards, it's pretty clear that in Sartre, there is a raging sense of rationality, a raging sense of monism, fitting things together. It's rather illustrative that in Sartre's notion of psychoanalysis, for example, that one of the notions he talks about is the fundamental project. This is something that each of us has, and this is what's supposed to replace the Freudian unconscious. Whereas Freud says there are these forces, or these experiences, or these affects that are somehow bubbling below the surface, which are not and cannot be made conscious, which cause us to behave in certain ways. Sartre, with his emphasis on choice and purpose, is saying basically each of us has a fundamental purpose in life. And what he means is something very basic. For example, when I talked about the desire to be God, the desire to be both in itself and for itself, that would be a kind of fundamental project. And the psychoanalytic move he makes in reaction to Freud is basically just that. To understand our fundamental project is to understand why we are acting in the way we are acting, and it has a kind of liberating effect. Well, liberation is exactly what the postmodernists seek too, but they seek it in a very different way. And in particular, instead of this kind of gathering together and monistic effort that goes into almost all of Sartre's discussions, despite his frequent discussions of the tension of human nature and all of that, the postmodernists rather would say, what we have to get rid of is just that sense of what they sometimes call totalization, just that sense, that rage for unity that has preoccupied Western philosophers virtually since the pre-Socratic philosophers. This is a thesis that they get rather directly from the later Heidegger, who also came to question some of the orientation of his earlier work, which is what we discussed. But the idea of rationality, the idea of a unified understanding, which was very much the proposal of the Enlightenment, which of course had a politics attached to it. And this is very much what many of the postmodernists want to reject, but what I want to say is that in many ways, Sartre had already anticipated them. Sartre also talks in a way that suggests that there is a form of rationality which actually escapes the bounds of many of the limitations of facticity and the notions of, for example, the entrapment we impose ourselves when we're talking about emotion. He talks from his very earliest works on about something he calls purifying reflection. And any good rationalistic philosopher can read this and, in a way, cheer, because the idea is that there is a way of thinking about ourselves, both personally and politically, which in some way removes us from prejudice and takes us into the realm of a kind of pure freedom. Now, there's a real question whether this is a thesis that will stand scrutiny within Sartre's own philosophy. But it's pretty clear that there's a sense, again, of this kind of uniform notion of one single ideal, which preoccupies his politics, certainly. It's the politics of freedom. And one has to say that he made a great many rather silly decisions on the basis of this politics. For example, his defense of various Stalinist regimes, including Stalin himself, for a considerable amount of time. And his sense that freedom, in a way, dominates all political considerations. It's on this regard that he came to blows with Albert Camus, who had previously been a good friend. Camus published a book called The Rebel in the mid-50s, in which, among other things, he talked about his own misgivings about the leftist campaigns in which he had been a part, and in particular, his support of dictatorships and authoritarian regimes. The idea was that freedom is not an excuse, and this rubbed Sartre, of course, very badly. In particular, freedom was not an excuse for cruelty and for inhuman behavior. And he called into question the devices of the Stalinists in particular and said in one of his famous essays, he wanted to be neither a victim nor an executioner, but find some way of being a good human being. Well, the idea of being a good human being never had much weight with Sartre, nor, in fact, did it have much weight with some of the postmodernists. But the idea is that for Sartre, the politics of freedom took priority over everything. For Camus, there was a much more mushy sense of what it was to be a good person, of not harming others, which took priority. And on this particular fact, they ended the relationship. The notion of power, which emerges most dramatically in Foucault, is an attempt to explain, among other things, why we have believed and why we have accepted the beliefs that we have over the course of history. In general, philosophers like to stress rationality in the sense of gathering evidence, the best arguments for the most plausible positions. Foucault, following Nietzsche, comes up with the rather frightening prospect that what the success of theories and the success of social movements and the success of even things like medicine have ultimately come down to had to do with superior power, in particular political power, although later in his career he starts talking too about those aspects of power which are more particular to individual relationships. Again, the notion of impersonality comes to the fore. And once again, I want to use Sartre and Camus as a way of pushing that back. The idea of thinking about our actions, whether they're individual or collective, in terms of impersonal explanations, is exactly what the humanism of both Sartre and Camus is aimed against. It's no accident that one of the targets that the postmodernists list, and this they follow the later Heidegger, is precisely humanism. It is a thesis which Sartre took very seriously, and when they reject it, one has to ask, exactly what is it to reject humanism? The notion becomes very particular with regard to the concept of the self. And here again, I think a very good point is made against Sartre, but one which I think Sartre anticipated and quite uncovered if one looks at his philosophy in its broader scope. Jacques Derrida, in particular, has become famous for rejecting the unified notion of the self. The idea is that the self is marginalized, it's fragmented, and it becomes a very real and difficult question in what sense we can identify the locus of responsibility. Here we'd want to talk, I guess, first of all, about political responsibility. Sartre, although, as I said, I think he made many foolish choices, was from beginning to end always steeped in the idea that as a writer, as a human being, he had responsibilities not just within his personal sphere, but always to the world, to manifest freedom and maximize freedom wherever he could. But the idea is that one took this responsibility through the choices and decisions that one makes. And the question that I always have for the postmodernists is, where is this notion of political responsibility in their work? Jacques Derrida, for example, has fairly recently defended a version of Marxism. But one can ask, in his defense of Marxism, again, where personal responsibility fits. And in the personal realm, again, there is this idea which keeps coming through in the postmodernists of our life and our experience, although like Heidegger, they don't like to use that word, being the result of impersonal forces. But what they underestimate and what they in some ways simply deny is what Sartre highlighted in terms of our personal responsibility for what we do, what we experience, what we are, and consequently, the way the world is. Let me go back to the notion of Sartre's contrast to Freud. Because as I said when we talked about Sartre and Freud, in fact, I think, while Sartre rejects Freud as his main target, the truth is that the two are much closer than either of them would probably admit. I summarize the difference by saying that wherever Freud says, "I cannot," indicating the forces of repression, what Sartre wants to say is, "I will not, I refuse," indicating a choice. But there was a book published about 15 years ago by the psychoanalyst Bruno Bettelheim, who knew Freud and obviously knew his German very well. And he defended Freud against his own translators and interpreters, stressing that what the Freudian project was really all about was a form of humanism. And many of the terms that are translated in the standard edition of Freud's works in English in a mechanistic way were in fact terms that much better fit into a kind of spiritual humanistic tradition. Words like soul, for example. When Sartre takes on Freud for his psychic determinism and the mechanistic interpretation he puts on that, one can raise the question whether Freud might not have, at many points, simply turned around and agreed. And in terms of the psychoanalytic project, which basically is a liberating project for Freud, liberating people from unconscious urges and the causes that made them neurotic and sometimes psychotic. For Sartre, it's liberating ourselves from wrong-headed projects, from fundamental projects that are just impossible, trying to understand exactly what we are in the world by our own choices. And purifying reflection here becomes absolutely essential. Because one asks, if all of one's behavior is essentially geared towards one fundamental aim, whatever that happens to be, where do we get the foothold to have a reflection which is not itself part of that project? Now, on the one hand, I think Sartre has a problem here. If you say that everything has to be conceived of within the scope of the project, then the question of how there could be a reflection which is truly purifying and also free from the strictures of the project itself becomes a very real problem. Nevertheless, for all of my hesitations, I think it's pretty clear that what Freud is arguing here is what we need in America now, in particular. The emphasis on personal responsibility, I think, is a very welcome antidote to the wave of victimization and the sense of blame manifest, for example, in our legal system, in the explosion in tort law and liability suits. I think the idea of a purifying reflection is absolutely essential in understanding the sense in which we must try to get a hold of ourselves by our own bootstraps, so to speak, and understand what we are doing and why. In an age of mindless consumerism, it seems to me to be absolutely essential to ask myself, as an American, what am I doing to the planet? What am I doing to the world society? What am I doing to myself? In short, I think existentialism is not at all passé, but it's rather exactly what we need once we've finished with this terrible but rather remarkable century.
I'm Tom Rollins, president of the Teaching Company. We hope you've enjoyed the lectures on these tapes. To order more courses or to receive a copy of our most recent catalog, call 1-800-TEACH-12. That's 1-800-TEACH-12. Or visit our website at www.teachco.com. Thank you very much for listening.